Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for joining us today. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. You know, when you're watching a movie, do you ever find yourself swept up not just by the story, but also by the score? Sometimes the musical compositions telegraph as much about what's happening as do the lines of the screenplay. This is the case with Nicholas Britell's musical scores. He composed music for 12 Years a Slave, and he wrote the score for The Big Short. In 2017, Britell was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Original Score and a Golden Globe Award for Best Original Score for Barry Jenkins' Oscar Best Picture winner, Moonlight. Barry Jenkins was on the show last week in anticipation of the wide release of his new film, If Beale Street Could Talk. And yes, Nicholas Britell was on board for that too. Awards Watch has said, listen to a track from Nicholas Britell's score, If Beale Street Could Talk, and swoon. Okay, listeners, let's swoon a little bit. Here's one of Britell's songs from the soundtrack.
You ready for this?
I've never been more ready for anything in my whole life. You know I love you, no matter what happens.
I'm yours in your mind, and that's it. You and me all the time.
Nicholas, welcome to the studio.
Thank you so much.
I just love that trailer because the relationship between these two who are in love is so important. And then the music just filling in the gaps and letting us know just how much love they are in.
Absolutely. And love was a huge part of the exploration of the film that Barry and I had. The film actually deals with so many different kinds of love, too. It deals with romantic love. It deals with erotic love. It deals with the love that parents have for their children. Mm-hmm. It even deals with a sort of almost like divine kind of pure love. And we actually named many of the pieces on the score album after the ancient Greek words for love. So there's a track called Agape, a track called Eros, a track called Storge, Philia, you know.
Yeah, we'll get to Eros in a minute.
Okay.
I want to talk about you for a minute. So you graduated from Harvard with a concentration in psychology.
Yes.
That's correct?
Yes.
And then you worked as a currency trader?
I was a currency trader for a little while.
And now you write sweeping scores for culturally relevant films. When did you decide music would be your life's work, considering you're clearly good at other things as well?
Well, you know, ever since I was really young, I was fascinated with music, and I started playing the piano when I was 5. And in a lot of ways, film music was something that was part of my life from the very beginning. I saw the movie Chariots of Fire when I was 5. Mm-hmm. And we had this very old upright piano in our apartment on West End Avenue. And right after seeing it, I went and tried to figure out how to play the theme from Chariots of Fire. And I asked my mom for piano lessons. So I always loved music. And I was I am a pianist, classical pianist. Mm-hmm. And I was in a hip hop band in college. And I played, you know, cocktail piano in bars and lounges. And it was in college where I was in that band. And also I started scoring friends' films. So that was kind of a very short, you know, history of my musical past.
Or were you a naturally musical kid? Some kids take to music because they're good learners or they're disciplined, and then some people just have it in their souls. What's your combination?
You know, I loved it, and I never viewed it as work in a lot of ways. I think I just, I was just so immersed in it. I loved going to Broadway musicals. My mom, when she was younger, was a musical comedy actress, and she sang in the house a lot. So, you know, I would hear Rodgers and Hart, and, you know, I was obsessed with Phantom and Les Mis and, you know, Broadway. And then and my dad, actually, every morning when we were, you know, he would drive me to school in the morning, and he would listen to actually the classical stations in New York. Mm-hmm. And listen to classical radio stations. I would listen to Mozart and Haydn and Schubert, and, you know, we'd play games of, you know, what composer is this? And it just becomes a part of your life.
When you were a little kid, did you ever listen to a score of a film and think, I would have done that differently? Was there any thought like, if I were scoring this, it would be like this?
I think it felt like such, all the music in the world, it just felt so almost like mystically powerful in some ways. Mm-hmm. That I don't even know if I ever really, I don't even know if I ever thought, you know, it was possible to be a composer, actually, you know, because it felt like this almost like distant kind of an idea of, you know, who writes music? How does mm-hmm. that even happen? Although I was always writing stuff. I remember right when I first started playing, I wrote a piece that was basically just these sort of repeated chords with a couple chords on top, and I called it the Train Symphony because I thought it sounded like sort of a train clanging along. But it was really in college that I started writing a huge amount of music and actually being in a band. You know, I had studied classical music for pretty much my whole life, but being in a band and getting to write music that that you could immediately go and perform for an audience and connecting with that. I remember in college I wrote, you know, I would write 2, 3, 4 pieces a day sometimes for years. And it's that kind of, I think once you get in a habit of writing music all the time, mm-hmm. it feels natural and doesn't feel like something distant anymore.
That's interesting you mentioned being in a band and that human contact, because before we went on the air, we were saying like you've been in your cave working on this.
Exactly.
And you know, when you're composing a score, there's yeah. not an audience. There's no one to really give you that immediate feedback. Do you think that experience being in a live band has helped you, I don't know, maybe anticipate what audiences will like or what they'll react to?
Absolutely. I think there's, you know, the context of music and the ways in which we receive music and connect with it, it varies. And there are so many different ways of interacting with music. I remember in classical music, I loved the music, but sometimes when I would go to a classical concert, I would see, you know, there's a stage and there's the audience. And sometimes I was almost wondering, like, what were you allowed to feel? You know, mm-hmm. There felt like there were sometimes rules. And I remember when I was in my band, there was this immediate connection, and it was inspiring, actually. It made me love performing more than ever. And thinking about that, that might also be one of the reasons I was so fascinated with psychology, because one of the things that I spent a lot of time reading about in college and in my classes was the music in the brain mm-hmm. and thinking about neuromusicology and, like, you know, how does the brain understand music and what is that? You know, it's a very almost kind of a profound question of, like, the fact that music is this integral part of almost all of our lives, and yet we don't really know why it works or how it works. We have theories, but we really don't know. And it's the fact that there are these sound waves that actually impact our emotions is a very kind of mystical thing that fascinates me.
We're speaking with Nicholas Bertelli, the composer. His latest work is If Beale Street Could Talk with Barry Jenkins. So how did you two meet? Is it true that he hired you without meeting you?
Well, so, I was...
Is the internet lying?
I just heard a story. We just realized something together a couple weeks ago, which is... So I was scoring The Big Short with Adam McKay, mm-hmm. and one night I was having dinner with Jeremy Kleiner, who is...
Hi, Jeremy.
One of the producers.
I know Jeremy.
Jeremy's amazing. Jeremy's amazing. And Jeremy Kleiner and Dee Dee Gardner are producers at Plan B. They're so inspiring, and they do such amazing work. Jeremy... at dinner got very emotional telling me about a script that he was, you know, that he read, that he was working on producing, called Moonlight. And I read it, and I thought it was the most beautiful thing I'd ever read. Honestly, mm-hmm. it felt like a piece of poetry. It felt like a poem as a script. And I said, you know, is there any way I can meet Barry? And so he connected the two of us, and we met up in downtown LA and had, you know, we were supposed to meet for coffee. We ended up having, you know, a bottle of wine, and we spoke for 2-3 hours just about life and music and movies. And we just started this conversation and talking, and we just started working together. And I only found out about 2 weeks ago that he had never heard my music before he hired me.
Oh, so, wow.
And I was like, wait, didn't Jeremy, like, send, you know,
like a link to something?
Something? Or? And he was like, no, I just like talking to you.
That's so interesting because I have to imagine you have to have a great deal of communicate. You have to be able to really communicate with your director, right?
Yes. Yes.
When you think about what your job is, what is your job?
My job is to talk to a director and to find somehow a sound that connects with their work in a way that they feel that is the essence of their ideal movie that they've made, mm-hmm. you know, and that is it's a very almost abstract process, because I think there's no right answer to what is the score for this movie. You know, what's the sound? All you can do is go on this journey together and approach it that way. Mm-hmm. You know, you talk, you feel things together, you spend time together, and you follow your feelings. And I think that is the ultimate test, is how does it make you feel? And then I think your thesis is, if I feel this way and we feel this way, then hopefully an audience will feel that way.
And the interesting thing in Beale, a couple of interesting things in Beale Street. One is that you talked about this idea of trying to find the sound of love. But there's also, there's a lot of tension and a lot of difficulty and a lot of political issues in this
Absolutely.
Film. So I want to play two different tracks. I want to play Eros, which is, as you said, one of those tracks about love. So let's listen to that. Speaking of love, is that your wife on the cello?
That is my wife on the cello, Caitlin Sullivan.
And then I also want to play this song, Hypertension.
Yes.
Let's listen to that. Can you describe for folks what this is about?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So there are these two very distinct but actually linked sound worlds in the film. The film explores love and the film explores injustice. Mm-hmm. And the world of love that you were hearing with the track Eros, what's something that we discovered was that there was this, you know, when I think for the first half of working on If Beale Street Could Talk, of the process, Barry and I were exploring this world of love and joy. And then there's a scene in If Beale Street Could Talk where the character Daniel is telling Fonny about his experience in prison. Mm-hmm. And there's a moment where there's a piece by Miles Davis, Blue and Green, playing on a record player. And then all of a sudden, we had this idea of what if emerging almost as a rumbling, as a this dark, almost horrific texture could come into the scene, and the audience's perception hopefully would change and realize the horrors of injustice. Mm-hmm. And of what, and you could actually feel, you know, we weren't trying to tell you what to feel. Hopefully you could feel the actual feeling of this sort of fear and horror. The track Hypertension that you played is another evolution of that distinct dark soundscape, which is that's the music that you hear when you see Officer Bell for the first time.
He's the officer who lies about Fonny's whereabouts, and Fonny ends up in jail for most of his life.
Exactly. And what's interesting about that music, though, is it's not actually music which is composed separately from the music of love. I actually took elements, the actual recording elements that I had written and recorded for the piece Eros, mm-hmm. and for other pieces in the movie, and distorted them and bent them. And Barry used the term, how can we break this? And that's what you're hearing. So that almost like siren alarm, mm-hmm. kind of sound, that's actually a saxophone from another part in the film where it's stretched out and it becomes this abrasive noise. And some of those, you know, some of those repetitive textures you're hearing in the background are actually elements of, those are some saxophones, there's some horns in the scene with Daniel and Fonny. That's some of the strings from Eros. So it's almost this very symbolic metaphor, but actually created this way, mm-hmm. where you're taking love and you're harming it, and the love is undergoing the same tragic transformation that's happening with Fonny in New York in the 1970s.
So the psychology major in you, I want to ask you this. Earlier with parts of the score, are you imprinting, are you planting that in our inner ear, our inner brain, so that when we hear this bending of it and this melding and this manipulation of it, are you doing that to us?
Maybe. I think what we, you know, one of the things that Barry and I believe very strongly, because we are always thinking about these kinds of ideas, and whether they are consciously noticed or whether they're unconsciously felt, I think that kind of thought process it impacts us, you know, and we hope that an audience feels that too. And thinking about the architecture, you know, you're kind of, you know, alluding to this idea that there's a map to the music in a film, which is related and tracks the form of the movie itself. And mm-hmm. how does that, you know, if we seed an idea early on and it evolves, how does that emotionally change things? How does that impact the audience?
We're talking to composer Nicholas Britell, and I have to ask you about this one piece of music you've created, because I love the description of it by a reviewer. You did the theme song for Succession, the HBO
yes.
show,
yes.
which is about this media mogul, this patriarch who thinks he's going to step down, but then maybe changes his mind as all his kids are jockeying to take over his job. We know what this is about. And this really interesting description of it said that your introductory music sounds like it's a character in the show. So let's listen. When you have a short period of time, like an intro to a television show, how do you get so much in one space? And what were you trying to accomplish there?
Well, ever since I was a kid, TV themes, you know, I grew up in the 80s, and TV themes were this thing. I was obsessed with TV themes. I mean, I remember, like, the theme song to, like, MacGyver, you know? I was obsessed with that, or Knight Rider, these kinds of things. And, you know, it's an art form in itself, you know? It's a short window of time where you're trying to sort of capture the essence of something. With Succession, you know, the stance that I took with the score in general was that it had a, hopefully, a gravitas and a seriousness, but there's also this kind of hyper absurdity to it, mm-hmm. which, you know, that there's this sort of massive hip hop beat there. And on top of that, I put this almost like kind of circus, like strange out of tune piano.
Right.
You know? So those things, I think there's, I've just always been fascinated with different elements and how can you fuse them in some way and create something new, I guess.
Your next project is the new movie about Dick Cheney, correct?
Yes.
So I'm guessing you're a pretty good student. Do you go back and read history when you're getting prepared to write something?
Absolutely. There's a lot of research and a lot of immersion in these. And I think that's one of the things that fascinates me about films, is that each project, each film is its own adventure that you're going to go on. And you get to immerse yourself in a world and study it and try to figure out how you're going to tell this story in its own way.
Nicholas Britell, it was a joy to meet you. Thank you so much. It was very interesting to learn about how you put together these luscious soundtracks.
Well, thank you so much for having me here. It was wonderful to talk to you.
Coming up next on All of It, did you ever wonder what New York City was like during World War II? Wonder No More, the author of Victory City, A History of New York and New Yorkers During World War II, joins us next. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. On August 14th, 1945, when it was announced that Japan had surrendered and World War II had come to an end, millions of New Yorkers gathered in Times Square. 15,000 light bulbs in the Times Tower spelled out the words, "Official, Truman announces Japanese surrender." This scene, described in a 1995 New York Times article, marked a turning point in the city's history. World War II is an incredibly important time in the history and the culture of New York. Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia regularly visited this radio station to broadcast updates to New Yorkers about the war. New Yorkers like Brooklyn's Melvin Kaminsky enlisted in the Army, and Leonard Schneider from Long Island joined the Navy. You might recognize them as Mel Brooks and Lenny Bruce. John Strausbaugh? Strausbaugh, yes.
Sure.
Is that right?
Well, I go with Strausbaugh.
Strausbaugh,
thank you.
I should have asked you before we went on air. John Strausbaugh has been writing about New York's history for 30 years, and his latest book, which comes out today, is Victory City, A History of New York and New Yorkers During World War II. There are so many interesting anecdotes in this book. I have to ask, just as someone who writes a little bit, how did you go about researching this? Where did you start?
I read. And as I'm reading, I start writing stuff down, picking out the stories that I think are interesting, significant, somehow build up to a composite picture. Then I end up throwing a lot of those away anyway. Otherwise, you know, this would have been three volumes instead of just one. And end up with what I hope is a kind of, you know, a portrait of the city in a lot of its aspects, through a lot of its characters, a lot of which we don't hear about very much in traditional histories, just because, you know, history tends to crunch it all down and compress it into a few handy memes and icons. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to go the opposite way and maybe give you too much to read.
Well, it's I like that because, you know, sometimes if you only read what certain historians have cherry-picked mm-hmm. are the moments we should know, you'll never know the rest, and there's so much in between.
Well, and if you're writing a book and you just end up writing the same book that a lot of other people have written, you know, what's the use of that? So I always try to not write the book that's been written yet.
It's interesting because I think of in this book, the city of New York is your protagonist.
Yeah.
So where is your protagonist in its life?
At that point, in between the World's Fair, which opened in 1939, and the laying of the cornerstone for the United Nations complex, which was almost exactly 10 years later, New York achieved its height of power and influence in the world. It was the biggest city in the world. It was the wealthiest. It was the busiest. It was the biggest seaport. It was the powerhouse of international finance and commerce and all these, and culture mm-hmm. and the media and all this stuff. So while the world is falling apart, all around it, New York is rising to its peak. And it was, you know, by the end of the war, New York was at its peak. It stayed there for quite a while. When the UN comes in 1949, mm-hmm. it's the capital of the world. And it's the queen of all cities for a while, into the mm-hmm. 60s. And then, you know, the inevitable decline comes.
What did the population of New York look like during this decade, 39 to 49?
Yeah, it was the, you know, like I say, it was the biggest city in the world. It was, at the 1940 census, it was 7.5 million people, which was huge. But it was also incredibly diverse and exceptionally cosmopolitan in its way. There were more Jews in New York City than anywhere in the world, more blacks in New York than in any other city in America, more Irish than in Dublin, almost as many Italians as in Rome, and more Germans than anywhere else outside of Germany, and on and on and on. It was a very diverse city in that sense. And then very diverse in other ways. You know, we think of it as the city. If we think about New York in World War II era, we think, you know, G.I. Joe, Rosie the Riveter, LaGuardia reading the funnies mm-hmm. to the kids on the radio, that sailor bending that poor girl in half in Times Square on VJ Day. And those were all legitimate stories, but it's New York City. So there are many, many, mm-hmm. many characters and many stories, and they are all over the map politically and socially and culturally and every other way you can think of.
One of the things I found fascinating was that there was an enclave of Nazi sympathizers.
It was
in New York City.
More than an enclave. Yeah. It's distressing to think about how many people were pro-fascist and pro-Nazi New Yorkers, homegrown mm-hmm. fascists and Nazis. There were enough that when they held rallies at Madison Square Garden, which was then up on 8th Avenue. It's not this Madison Square Garden. But they packed it with more than 20,000 people. And they're mm-hmm. cheering, and they're Sieg Heiling, and they're singing the Horst Wessel song, and there are giant swastikas draping them. There are newsreels of the biggest and most famous of these, which mm-hmm. happened in 1939. But it was far from the only one. There were smaller ones all through Brooklyn and the Bronx. You could easily get a few thousand people together to celebrate Hitler's birthday, cheer for Mussolini. There was a big strain in New York City.
What were the conditions like that led people to decide to support Nazism in New York City?
Well, again, they're kind of all over the map. They're in obvious places like the big Italian immigrant and big German immigrant communities. Mm-hmm. Of course, those folks, that's where you'd expect to find it. But there were Park Avenue blue bloods who were just very conservative and thought he had the right idea. You know, there was a lot of people who wanted a strong man. The autocratic ruler mm-hmm. seemed like a good idea at the time because in a lot of ways, politically, the world was falling apart all around us. There was also a very strong impulse. A lot of people thought that communism was a much bigger threat than either the Nazis or the fascists or the Japanese. So that led them to be pro-Hitler, pro-fascist, pro-Mussolini, because they saw those guys as bulwarks against the spread of communism. So you could find Nazi and fascist sympathizers pretty much in every sector of New York community in the 30s.
Another issue, which is upsetting and disturbing, obviously, are Japanese internment camps.
Yeah.
And we actually have some tape. We edited a bit of Mayor LaGuardia on the day of Pearl Harbor, which we're coming up on the anniversary of mm-hmm. this week. And it's really interesting to listen to him describe what will happen in the city or what should happen in the city in the immediate aftermath. So let's play this, and I'd love to get your take on the other side.
I now want to appeal to the people of our city to be calm. But I want to repeat what I said before, that we are not out of the danger zone by any means. As mayor of the city of New York, and on my own responsibility, I have ordered all Japanese subjects to remain in their homes until their status is determined by our federal government. In the meantime, know that your city government is on the job and looking after your welfare and comfort and safety.
What happened to these quote-unquote subjects?
Yeah, as he was speaking, that's his famous speech on, I think it was WNYC.
Yeah, it was,
yeah,
yes.
On December 7th, on the afternoon of Pearl Harbor. And as he was speaking, the police and FBI were going out to at first just make sure nobody, no Japanese in the city. And there weren't a lot. It was not a big community. I think there were under 10,000. But that they didn't leave home. And then they started rounding them up. They were taken to Ellis Island. From Ellis Island, they were taken to internment camps. And they included people like, there was a man who was a doctor. He had lived in New York City since, I think, 1908. He had an office on Park Avenue, but he was Japanese. And they rounded him up, and he spent the war in an internment camp. So,
in terms of also Mayor LaGuardia saying your government is here for you. Was the government here for New Yorkers, and in what way?
That is a really interesting question. He, of course, thought that he was the government. He,
yes.
Speaking of autocratic rulers, LaGuardia ran New York City with an iron fist and a huge temper, too.
And a little barrel of a man, that, as you described.
Stuffed with dynamite. And he, people called him Butch, but they also called him Napoleon and Mussolini. If it was up to him, he would have mobilized the entire city to become his own city military corps. He did end up doing a version of that, but he got turned down in the larger version that he wanted to do. He really would have liked to have locked down the city. There would have been absolute martial law. He took it very seriously that the Germans might somehow manage to fly bombers over New mm-hmm. York. And there were some legitimate fears of that at first until everybody realized, well, they're not going to be able to do that. But meanwhile, U-boats were lurking right off Coney Island. And mm-hmm. and every ship that was coming out of the harbor that looked like a juicy cargo ship was being sunk by these U-boats for the first several months of the war. So he had some legitimate fears for New York. As the war goes on, people relax. Nobody's showing up for their volunteer marching around mm-hmm. at night that he had gotten them all to do it first. And it calms down.
We're speaking with John Strasbaugh, Victory City, A History of New York and New Yorkers During World War II. It comes out today, by the way. This is really interesting. You talked about how during this period that New York, the city itself, its stature, but also that New Yorkers were essentially running the United States.
Yeah.
You write, it's no exaggeration to say that from the day President Roosevelt took office in 1933 to the day he died in 1945, New Yorkers ran the country. How so?
He of course, was a New Yorker, and he and Eleanor get there in March of 1933. From there through the spring of 1945, when he dies, they bring just a tremendous number of people from New York City, and people of all types. So there's political operatives and speech writers. The playwright Robert Sherwood, who wrote Petrified Forest, mm-hmm. Becomes one of his speech writers. His right-hand man was basically a social worker in New York City who came down and lived with him in the White House and was the closest thing he had to a close friend, and people called him the assistant president through the entire war. There were Wall Street bankers, lawyers, just like all kinds of New Yorkers, and they're all going down to D.C. Mm-hmm. And I say that, you know, while FDR was in office, D.C. was like Gotham on the Potomac.
It's interesting. My mom, my late mom, was born in 1929. I remember her saying to me one day, I didn't know you could have another president besides a Roosevelt.
Yeah.
And for how did New Yorkers feel about that, this idea of this is their president for this long?
Yeah, New Yorkers who liked him adored him. So people in the garment industry, for instance, he was huge in the garment. He was less big with Italian New Yorkers because he said that Mussolini had stabbed the world in the back. And so they got the voting for him dropped immensely after he said that. He wasn't so big with German Americans in New York, and that was another big community. But people who liked FDR adored him, as they still do. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's still considered one of, if not the greatest president in history. And New Yorkers loved that he was from New York. LaGuardia, of course, loved it. LaGuardia went down to visit him so often that the city eventually just rented him an apartment in D.C. to make it easier for him to be hitting him up all the time. All through the Depression, of course, he was hitting him up for funds and jobs and because New York was terribly hit, like everywhere else, by mm-hmm. the Depression. Then during the war, he was hitting him up. LaGuardia was the sort of man, being mayor of New York City, the second busiest job in the world, or at least in the United States, was not enough for him. He also wanted to be Secretary of War, and he wanted to be a colonel, and he wanted to do this and that. And so he was always going down there and importuning poor FDR, who liked him a lot. They'd been friends for a long time, so he found it hard to say no to him, but once in a while he did.
During this time, what was going on with African Americans in the city? Because obviously the military was not desegregated until Truman in 1948.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what was the disposition of African Americans in the city towards the war?
It's a very interesting question. Of course, Harlem and Brownsville and Bed-Stuy, the big black communities in New York, were hit hardest by the Depression. Blacks were the first mm-hmm. people fired when the Depression hit. They had already been paying exorbitant rents in places like Harlem, and their rents actually went up during the Depression. And then the war comes. Some are drafted. Some men are drafted. Some volunteer. But in general, the community's attitude is, wait, why are we being asked, or volunteering even, to go fight oppression overseas when we are being so repressed here at home? So that, and a lot of the men who went into service said that they were as least as mistreated in the military, if not more so, than they had been in civilian life. So there's a lot of resentment, there's a lot of anger, with a whole lot of good reason. And it builds up to the summer of 1943, riots explode on army bases. Black soldiers mm-hmm. are rioting in many cities. Detroit had a terrible riot, and there was an overnight riot in Harlem in this August 1, 1943. When it's over, the mayor and J. Edgar Hoover and the newspapers are all trying to assign blame to outside agitators. It was the communists. It was the zoot-suited juvenile delinquents who started it. But when they looked at the hundreds of people who were arrested, it was a cross-section of Harlem society. So it was, as Adam Clayton Powell Jr. and other mm-hmm. black leaders pointed out at the time, it was the community saying enough of this and rising up in this riot, in this revolt. Nothing came of it, of course. As we know, the situation continues. And I think there was a commission, you know, the mayor appointed a commission to study. So, of course, blah, blah.
Is there something that we here in New York maybe take for granted or don't realize that we have or changed or affects our lives that's a direct result from this period?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I haven't really thought about that before. But, you know, this is not the city that it was back then. We have to admit that to ourselves. It's not the capital of the world anymore. It's not the the country and in many ways the rest of the world has, things have been so dispersed. Communications are dispersed, businesses dispersed, populations have been dispersed. Like back in 1940, a tenth of the population of the United States lived in the greater metro New York area. It was, you know, this monstrous magnet for people. And then they build all the roads and people spread out. So what we have left over from then, rent control.
Yeah. That's important.
Yeah, yeah.
So before I let you go, do you have one story in the book that I haven't asked you about that you think is really important or one that you just particularly love?
I love Dorothy Thompson, journalist.
Yes.
She's one of my fave characters from the book, and I did not know much about her because she has sort of faded from history. Everybody knows Dorothy Parker, but back in the 30s and 40s, Dorothy Thompson was the much bigger deal. She was the second most widely read newspaper columnist in the country behind Walter Winchell. She was the first American journalist expelled from Germany for criticizing Hitler in 1934. You got to love that.
Mm-hmm.
and then in 1939, when the New York Nazis are throwing their big rally at Madison Square Garden, there are two disruptions. One, a young Jewish man from Brooklyn rushes the stage and is carried off. But in the other, there's somebody in the press gallery laughing and hooting at all these guys standing up there giving their speeches about how great Hitler is and how awful Roosevelt. And it turns out it's Dorothy Thompson. And they take her out again. So she was expelled twice for heckling Nazis. You gotta love that.
John Sprousbaugh's new book is called Victory City, A History of New York and New Yorkers During World War II. You have two events, one at the General Society of Mechanics on December 6th at 6:30 p.m. and the Brooklyn Historical Society on December 12th at 6:30 p.m. John, thanks for coming down to All of It.
Thanks a bunch for having me.
We'll be back after a quick break with the star of a new film, Dumplin', the story of a Texas teen who, to prove a point, enters a local pageant run by her ex-beauty queen mom. We'll also talk to the woman who wrote the book on which the film is based. Stay with us. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. A new movie called Dumplin' isn't your average coming-of-age beauty pageant tale. It tells the story of a pretty plus-size southern teenage girl named Willa Dean Dixon, who signs up for her mom's beloved beauty pageant as a bit of a protest. But her plan soon changes when other contestants follow in her footsteps, revolutionizing the pageant scene in their small Texas town in the process. Let's listen to a clip.
I think I'm going to sign up for the pageant and do what Lucy never could. I want to march right in there on sign-up day just to see the look on my mom's face. She's always been embarrassed by me, now she'll have good reason.
Kind of like a protest in heels?
Exactly, like a protest in heels.
Dumplin' stars Jennifer Aniston and Danielle McDonald as the mother and daughter duo, and it's based on the best-selling young adult novel by author Julie Murphy. The film premieres on Netflix this Friday, December 7th, and we're so happy to have Danielle and Julie in the studio. Hi, guys.
Hey, hi. Thanks for having us.
Julie, so this was your second novel, is that right?
Yes.
It became a New York Times bestseller. Not a lot of people get to say that. What was your inspiration for this character in this story?
You know, I had been waiting a really long time to write a character about a fat book. Or no, I'm sorry, a book about a fat character. Because your listeners can't see me, I am a fat woman. I'm a plus size woman.
Wearing a fabulous sweater, by the way.
Thank you.
Very sparkly.
I know, I love this sparkle so much.
Well, and I had always dreaded seeing fat characters on TV or in books or in movies. They were always the same thing. They were always desperate, the butt of the joke, or in like some need of losing weight in order to be in any way redeemable as a character.
That's annoying.
Yeah, it's really annoying.
Yeah.
I think that anyone who stands out in any kind of way is used to being pigeonholed for whatever it is that makes them a minority or being different. And I think that I was just so irritated with that and ready for something new. And I was finally in a position where I was writing and had a relationship with a publisher. And I figured, why not me? Why can't I write this story?
How old were you when you wrote this?
Well, I think that I was probably about 28 or 29.
So how did you find an authentic teenage voice? Because that's a good deal. I'm a lot older than you are, but that's a good deal removed from being a teenage girl.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've always been a little bit immature, but I'm also a former young adult librarian.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. That's
so
interesting.
Yeah, so that really helped me get into that mindset. But also at the end of the day, I mean, teenagers are just people. And they, of course, they have like slang and lingo, but they feel and talk just like regular people. Sometimes it's a little bit more immediate, but they're just people.
And where and when did you find out this was optioned as a film?
I was sitting in like a Panera or something. And it was a few months before the book was about to come out. And I found out it was going to be optioned in the summer of 2015. And this has been an ongoing process since then. So it's been incredible.
Daniel, let's bring you in. How did you get attached to this project?
I had actually read the book. It was funny because I was just walking through a bookstore one day and I like halted in my tracks, turned and was like, why is there a cartoon version of me on a book right now? Like, it was really weird because I don't see myself on books. Mm-hmm. And that was strange to me. And I immediately like took a photo because I was in a run and I was like, I have to get this book. I have to get it. And I read it in a day. I didn't sleep. I just stayed up and read it and it hooked me in. And, you know, it felt like I felt as a teenager. Like, I felt like the voice was just so true, and it's something that I went through. It's something that I know a lot of people go through. And I was obsessed with it, and I heard that it was being made into a movie, and I was like, oh my God. Like, I would kill to. They'll never want me, but I would kill to do this. And it somehow miraculously happened.
Describe Willa Dean, the main character, for folks.
Oh, man. I think you could probably do it better, Julie. But
we can together. We can it's group effort.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, to me, Willa Dean is a teenager who is trying to figure out who she is. She's battling with insecurities and, like, sudden... She has confidence, but it's a lot of a protective mechanism as well because... She has a confidence. She knows what she wants. And that's almost why she's pissed off that she has these insecurities, because she knows she shouldn't. And that's, I felt that way. And that's like such a thing that you have to overcome within yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's got like the sarcastic and biting humor that she almost uses as a defense mechanism sometimes. But it's also really funny and entertaining, I think. Yeah. But yeah, it's really like that false sense of confidence. Like, I want to be confident. I know I should be confident. But because society has taught me I shouldn't be confident, I'm not confident.
Yep. We're speaking with Julie Murphy, who wrote the book Dumplin, and Daniel McDonald, who stars in the film version, which is going to be on Netflix. Jennifer Aniston plays your mom. And let's play a little clip so we can kind of understand their relationship.
The thing is, I kind of forgot about tonight. I already made plans with Bill.
We made a deal. This cannot exactly drive itself. Okay? Bring him. She'll love it. Do I have any holes back here? Oh, baby. You got a little breakout there on your forehead. You're not eating that greasy stuff over at Harpy's, right?
Mom, you know I don't even like burgers and hot dogs.
Yeah, but...
You've got a hole in your left, by the way.
What? All right, will you please tell Elle that she's got to be ready in 10?
Oh, she didn't listen to me.
She's got a hole in her beehive. Yeah. The worst thing that could happen to a former beauty queen. And, you know, she keeps calling her Dumplin', even though Willa Dean hates it. A, why does she keep calling her that? I'll ask you, Julie, and then why does she hate it, Daniel?
Well, I think that Dumplin' is a nickname that makes it easier for Jennifer Aniston's character, Rosie, to accept her daughter a little bit more. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like a gentler version of saying fat. And I think that Willa Dean hates it for those same reasons, because every time she hears Dumplin', she hears fat, and she's kind of just like, just call me what you see. Mm-hmm. I hate this little nickname that you've given me my whole life.
How do you see their relationship, Daniel?
Their relationship? Complicated. Very complicated. I think that everyone has, at some points, a complicated relationship with their mom. Like, you have to get on the same page, and especially when mothers are so protective, and I think that that is where Rosie is coming from. She's like, I want what's best for you, and I know how society treats people, but she never was able to overcome that in herself. She conformed to society rather than being confident with who she is, and so she's just teaching her daughter what she knows, because that's what she did. Doesn't mean it's right. It doesn't, like, they really have to get on the same page. And that's kind of what we're trying to figure out in the film. I feel like it's really them trying to come to some kind of, I don't know, agreement in a weird way. Yeah, some balance.
And I do like the way that you wrote the part and that Jennifer Aniston plays the part of the mother, because she's not really a villain.
Right.
She's not this evil mom who wants her daughter to be something else. She actually in her own weird way is coming from a place like she thinks she's protecting her.
Yeah,
right.
And she's loving her.
And like Danielle said, Rosie is a victim to all of this too. Like, mm-hmm. Rosie conformed to society because, you know, she, in the book, she grew up overweight as well. And she conformed to society because it's all she knew how to do to survive.
Yeah.
In the book and in the movie, she has an older sister who has since passed away named Lucy, who's really a prevalent presence in the movie. And she was also overweight and plus size. And Rosie sort of always felt like her life was less because of it.
Yet Lucy's life was completely, she was glamorous
yeah.
and loving yeah. and really sort of embraced Willow Dean and wanted Willow Dean to embrace who she was.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that that's like a really important figure in Willow Dean's life and helping her to find self-acceptance.
We have to talk about Dolly Parton. Dolly Parton yeah. plays a big role in this film, not as she's in the film, but her music and what she's about is so integral and important to the character of Willow Dean. Yeah. Can you explain how where Dolly Parton comes into this?
I mean, Julie wrote it, but I mean, Dolly Parton is just, she is a woman that champions other women. Mm-hmm. And she is all about self-love and self-acceptance. And like, I was hearing all of her quotes while I was on set, and I was like, whoa, I didn't know this. She is so cool. And she genuinely is that person. She is that person that is just always positive and always thinking forward, and it's like accepting of everyone. And that is such a positive message in this movie, and that is what Will wants. So she's striving towards that, and Dolly is just her big influence.
And in the movie, there are some drag queens who come in, and they all come in as Dolly Parton.
Yeah, they're Dolly Parton impersonators.
Impersonators, I should say. Excuse
yeah.
me.
Yeah.
That's appropriate.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, just in the gay community in general, Dolly Parton is a huge deal. So I knew that when I was writing Dolly, I wanted to figure out how to work in drag queens somehow. But for me, Dolly Parton's always kind of been like this sort of like patron saint. And that's really what she is for Willow Dean, too. Like you said, like she is just a great advocate for other women. And you see her and you think, okay, well, you know, she's got the song Dumb Blonde, and like she fits like the picture of like Dumb Blonde, like huge hair, big boobs, like mm-hmm. this is the ideal. But in reality, like every decision that Dolly Parton has made about herself, her body, her business is very deliberate, and it's of her own accord. It's really incredible.
Let's listen to a clip of Willow Dean explaining Dolly to a young man she's interested in, whose name is Bo. Of course it's romance.
What's the deal with that photo in your locker, that girl woman?
You don't know who Dolly Parton is?
Should I?
She's like one of the greatest singer-songwriters of all time. She's kind of hard not to know.
Okay. Why her?
My Aunt Lucy loved her. I'm probably saying Dolly before I could talk. There's just something amazing about her. You know, she's in on every joke you could possibly tell about her, and she's got this wicked sense of humor, and it's like she's always one step ahead, you know?
And Dolly Parton's music, and Dolly Parton wrote a song for the film, right?
She wrote six.
Six songs.
A whole album.
That's amazing. Six originals, right?
Yeah.
And re-recorded some.
Right.
Yeah.
How did you get her on board?
Well, you know, we knew we couldn't make this project happen without her, even if it was just access to her backlist.
Mm-hmm.
And the film was actually filmed independently. And so we knew that she was kind of like the secret sauce. Like, we had to make Dolly happen. And so when they approached Dolly, they said, you know, would you be willing to write a song for the movie and let us have some of your backlist? And they didn't want to be too greedy. And she was just really, really generous with us and, like, did it for, like, you know, I don't want to say free, not free, but she did it.
But for an indie budget.
Yeah, she did it for our budget.
She accommodated the budget.
Yeah,
she did.
And then she turned around and wrote six songs. I mean, like some of the songs have like characters of the movie in it. Like it's just, I feel like a lot of soundtracks don't really necessarily match the movie, but this was like custom fit for the movie. It's incredible.
And I have to ask you, Danielle, people can hear that you have an Australian accent.
Yeah.
And people probably remember you from your breakthrough work on Patty Cakes in 2017, where you had to master a Jersey accent learn to rap with a Jersey accent. We're going to play a tiny bit because with the 10 seconds we could find that were clean, let's play it.
Over that rainbow, we pay tolls with Rhodola, paved golden angels in gold chains. The nighttime is day glow. I'm Jane Doe, a loser. This is so confusing. I just want to move with my life like a movie. Should be getting busy.
So, any of them is Texas accent for this movie.
Didn't expect to hear that.
Tell me about your accent work.
I mean, it was funny because I was promoting Patty Cakes at the time that we were in pre-production for Dumplin'. So I think I went to the Patty Cakes premiere and then flew straight to Atlanta and went into filming. So I didn't have much time. And when I was doing press, everyone was like, can you do a Jersey accent? I'm like, I'm trying to be Southern right now. I don't know what my brain is doing. And then my accent is whatever it is now. For me, it's repetition, listening over and over. You get on set, everyone else has the same accent. It helps. So that was really what it was.
It's a really fun movie. Yeah. It's a really sweet movie. It's got a really good message and great Dolly Parton songs on top of it all. Julie Murphy and Daniel McDonald, thank you so much for coming by the studio.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Dumplin' will be out on Netflix on December 7th. You've been listening to all of it on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. We'll meet you on the other side of the news.
NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With 3 updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City. By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging and an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.